Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mary Doria Russell, whose latest novel is Epitaph, a novel of the OK Corral. Previous novel, Doc, which is about Doc Holliday, and Epitaph is a continuation of that story. Also, Dreamers of the Day, A Thread of Grace, Children of God, and The Sparrow. Children of God and The Sparrow are science fiction novels, and Children of God is a sequel to The Sparrow. This is a Western. The last time I interviewed you, I think it was for Dreamers of the Day, you mentioned that you were doing Doc, and I remember thinking, a Western? Wow. So let's go back
to... Well, they're Westerns the way that The Sparrow was science fiction, too. I mean, I'm using the genre as a jumping-off point, but really I have thought of all of them as historical fiction, even The Sparrow, which takes place in the future. But the narration in The Sparrow is as though a Jesuit historian is looking back on it all from a distance of about 150 years. So even if it was taking place a century from now, it still was supposed to be a historical novel.
Let's go back and talk about the origins of Doc, because that led you to Epitaph. What brought you to write about Doc Holliday and the Earps?
Well, I didn't intend to write about the Earps so much. I intended to write about Doc Holliday. And one of the consistencies in my very inconsistent writing career has been that I'm drawn to those I feel are unfairly maligned. Now, how I got started on the whole business is really easy to answer. Two words, Val Kilmer. Okay, Tombstone's great show. It was a charming performance as Doc Holliday. And I got interested in what seemed like really contemporary background issues. Gang warfare along the Mexican border, equal rights for women, gun control, all of these things seemed very, very contemporary to me. So I started with a biography of Doc, John Henry Holliday. My research started with the biography by his great-grandniece, Karen Holliday Tanner. She had access to family papers and memoirs that had never been revealed before, and was willing to say for the first time in all the generations since he was born that John Henry Holliday was born with a cleft palate and a cleft lip that has run in the family for the generations since. In the South at the time, that was evidence of tainted blood, and if anybody had known that a child was affected that way, nobody would have married into the Holliday family, so it was kept very quiet. I was stunned to find out that his uncle, John Stiles Holliday, performed the first cleft palate surgical repair in North America on the child that would become Doc Holliday in the future. His mother invented speech therapy for him. It was just this extraordinary family and this bright, quiet, shy, beautifully educated boy who began to die when he was 21 years old. He went west for his health. And that was my entree into the West. Not isolated boom towns and cattle drives and cowboys and all that. It was this beautifully educated young man who spoke Latin and Greek and French and played piano, classical piano, and that's where I got started.
For those who may not know this, Doc Holliday was one of the people involved, along with the Earp brothers, Wyatt Earp and his brothers Virgil and Morgan, who had a gunfight at the OK Corral in Tombstone, Arizona, which, of course, didn't actually happen in the OK Corral.
No, but it takes way too long to say. The misdemeanor arrest in the vacant lot behind Camillus Fly's photography studio near the corner of Fremont and First, a little north of the OK Corral. You know, that's just the first of many simplifications.
This particular gunfight, which lasted a minute.
30 seconds.
30 seconds.
30 seconds, 30 bullets.
Became a major story back east, and it was that major story that set in motion what I guess is now one of the definitive myths of the Old West.
Yes, and that was what I was really interested in. So much had been changed, starting with the fact that if you watch the movies, well, first of all, 40 feature films? Why do we keep telling this story over and over and over? There are 1,000 books. What keeps us coming back to it? Why did this 30-second misdemeanor arrest move to the center of what we believe about frontier justice in the Old West? I was interested in the making of the myth, the simplifications that took place. Why is John Henry Holliday portrayed as a violent drunk? How did Wyatt become the hero of the piece when it was his brother Virgil who was the officer in charge? The McLowry brothers. How did Tommy McLowry, who is an inoffensive alfalfa farmer, how does he get turned into an outlaw who deserves to die? And in writing it, the book, I have been very much struck by how topical it's become. The whole issue of officers shooting unarmed civilians and why it is so difficult to get an indictment of a police officer, let alone a conviction. If you read Epitaph, you'll understand that. And I say that as a cop's daughter. It's a tough job. I get both sides of this.
The story also incorporates women of the frontier, which I guess was also always in the back of your mind.
Right. I looked at both the way the story has been told and the way the history took place. And the only reason that we know Wyatt Earp's name at all is because his wife, Josephine Marcus Earp, became obsessed with the idea of pruning the story and shaping the facts and creating this paragon, the flawless lawman of the lawless West. And that's how he's remembered, because of the way she insisted that his authorized biography be written. So it was very important to me to tell her story, because she's the only reason that we know any of it.
Going back to Doc, though, I mean, that's a slightly different story than Epitaph, because
oh, yes.
It's focused on Doc
himself.
Doc Holliday.
Yes. He was nobody's sidekick. And he would have been terribly offended by the idea that he existed to be the sidekick to Wyatt Earp.
In writing Doc, you could focus in on Doc and Katie, to some degree, mm-hmm. his girlfriend.
Yeah, Kay Haroni, yeah.
But Epitaph is a much broader story.
It is. In a lot of ways, this pair of books is very similar to the first pair that I wrote. Like The Sparrow, Doc is a more intimate story. There are one-on-one conversations. It is a finding of your way through an alien countryside in both cases. The central character is someone who's tremendously appealing, but also very troubled and trying very hard to make his way in this very frightening world. With Children of God and with Epitaph, you have to pull back for a wider establishing shot. You've got many more elements of that story that have to be told.
That means that you're expanding the number of point of view characters.
Yes.
And at some point, you have to kind of go, well, why am I making this particular character a point of view character?
And
that must have been very difficult.
Because I knew why they were going to be important later on, I did ask for a little bit of patience. When you're learning about John Clum, who became the mayor of Tombstone, I do kind of let you know, this is the man who's going to give Virgil Earp the order to go down there and disarm those people. So that's why John Clum is important. And I do try to let you know, I'm not just gassing off here. There's a reason. The other thing about writing this book was, because the story in mythology for the last 133 years has been so narrowed down to it becomes Wyatt and Doc. It's their story. I needed to pull back and say, no, this is also the story of the McLowry brothers. This is the story of Ike Clanton. Ike Clanton's still got family that lives down in Tombstone. My take on the book began when a woman named Pam Potter approached me after I did a talk on Doc.
Had you planned to do that?
No. Oh, no, no. I thought it was going to be standalone. I thought, you know, oh, there's so much that's already been done about the gunfight at the OK Corral. What could I possibly say?
So you were just going to end it.
This was going to be a one-off.
With he goes off to Tombstone.
Right. Exactly. And I figured, at that point, go watch the movie. We're done. But Pam came up to me and said, I am the great-great-granddaughter of Tom and Frank McLowry. And I want you to know that they did not go to Tombstone that day to fight it out with the Earps. They were on their way to my great-grandmother's wedding. And boy, did that snap my eyes open. Now there are many more things to look into about this. This is Tommy McLowry's story. This is Frank McLowry's story. And I wanted to pull back and give everybody, I think of it as an opera where everybody gets their aria.
Mary Doria Russell, had you done much research on the gunfight during the writing of Doc?
No. I mean, I knew that they were all headed that way. I knew that was coming in 81. But I was writing about 1878, which was the last year that 26-year-old dentist felt well enough to hang out a shingle and practice his profession. And that's where he met the Earps. That's the year that he met Kate Haroni. It was a watershed year for all of the people who then went on to Tombstone. And I wanted to give a sense of who they were as human beings before they became mythological creatures.
And then you discovered about the McLowry brothers.
Yes.
And that kind of expanded the story almost into the story of Tombstone itself.
Yes.
Which
the city itself is a character. Yeah.
Which existed because of the silver mines.
Yes. Everybody seems to have this feeling that it was all about, like, again, in order to simplify it, to get it to be a movie, it becomes the lawmen versus the cattle rustlers. Okay. I can tell you right now, cows had nothing to do with what happened on October 26, 1881. Cows were not involved in any way.
The villains, or the rustlers, they are called the cowboys.
Yes.
But when they're called the cowboys, it's kind of a pejorative term that's being used to say they're the gang members.
Yes. Yeah. And old man Clanton really was the Al Capone of his day. I mean, he was organizing places, and he was quite sophisticated about how he was doing this. The idea was that you would cross the Sonoran border into Mexico. You would steal Mexican cattle, race them over the border, fatten them up in several of the valleys that had good grazing in southeastern Arizona, and then sell them on to the miners in Tombstone and to the army and to Indian reservations. There's quite a bit of money in this. And he understood the law well enough to understand if he had private property along the way, nobody could come and get him.
There's something called the posse comitatus.
Posse comitatus, yes.
And that means that he can't be chased by the army.
That's right. That's right. And that, in turn, goes back to a sort of moment like, I don't know if people will remember, but the Branch Davidian and the disaster at Waco. In this case, it was the Lincoln County War, where the army went in to settle something that was basically about who could sell dry goods in Lincoln County. It became a shooting war. They set fire to some buildings hoping to drive people out, and instead civilians were burned to death. So there was this, you know, an enormous political backlash, and the Posse Comitatus law said that the army could no longer be involved in civilian law enforcement. Boy, did people in Arizona take advantage of that.
So when you're investigating this, you discover certain things, like, not surprisingly, the law was pretty corrupt. You discover that there are the shades of the Civil War going on.
Oh, yeah. It's 20 years after the end of the war. Many of the people who are involved in the story that I tell in Epitaph are the younger brothers of those who fought. The men in their 30s and 40s are the people who fought in the war. But now you've got younger brothers who were too young to get into the war. And in a lot of ways, it's like after World War II, where you have a generation coming up that didn't ever really prove their manhood in combat. And there's a lot of psychological fallout from that. Politically, you had a war that is recent memory that has literally split the country in two. And in the same way that Vietnam continues to resonate in the politics of today, the Civil War continued to resonate in the politics of America for more than a generation. To this day, if you look at what's happening in South Carolina. In the Silver City, in Tombstone, you had Yankees, industrialists, Republicans who were Lincoln supporters and often Union veterans. They're in the city, and they are surrounded by ranchers who are many of them ex-Confederates who moved to Arizona because it was the last best place to get out from under the federal government, who were tremendously hostile to anything that had to do with the feds. And you had two newspapers. It's like MSNBC and Fox. And they're spinning everything that's happening. It's remarkably contemporary.
Why would a city be named after a gravesite?
Okay, yeah, this is a funny story, and it's real. Ed Shefflin, who was the prospector who found the initial silver strike, until like a few months before he went down to this area, this was Chiricahua land, and they had just been moved off onto a reservation. Geronimo still had troops in the hills above this, and they were not happy about white people coming into their land. And the soldiers told Ed Shefflin, you're not going to find anything out there but your tombstone. And he comes up with this lump of nearly pure silver, off the charts for purity. Within 2 years, he and his brother and Richard Gird, who did their assaying, were all millionaires. There was an industrial development there that just sprang up out of nowhere.
In Tombstone, there were several fires, so it's kind of hard to get a sense of what the town looked like. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was quite sophisticated. At the time, they were talking about it being the next San Francisco. Really good hotels and restaurants and professional offices and banks, and it was really quite sophisticated.
How big was it? How many?
20,000 people at the peak. There was one census before it kind of was burned up. There are still people there to this day. It didn't disappear, but its peak was at about 20 to 25,000 people.
And at that point, there were restaurants. Did you get a menu?
Yeah, there were newspapers with ads for what was available. And they were shipping in oysters from the coast, and there was champagne. And, yeah, it was very up to the moment.
Let me ask you this, Mary Doria Russell, since you're kind of on a debunking mission of sorts. That means that you have to get it as accurate as possible every step of the way.
Yes.
Assuming that, obviously, in some stories you have to pick one or the other. You have to pick Fox News or MSNBC.
Yeah, exactly, right? Exactly.
Where did you go off, other than in the minds of the characters, where did you go off from history? Did you go off from history?
I can tell you exactly what's fiction. Okay, any scene with Doc Holliday and Josie Marcus is fiction. Tom McLowry, I have given him a crush on Morgan's wife, Louisa. In history, we believe that it was actually James Earp, who was the oldest of the brothers, James Earp's stepdaughter. Now, the problem with that was I had written all of Doc and never mentioned that he had stepkids, because I didn't want to make more complication in that story. So rather than say, oh, by the way, James had two stepdaughters, and Tom McLowry had a crush on one of them, it was better to take Louisa and develop her and Tom, because they were both sweet, decent, good people. And I think they would have made a good couple, even though Louisa really did love Morgan. And Tom never took advantage. He was a good boy. So it gave me an opportunity to give some heart to the story and to reveal both of their characters.
But that's pretty much it. Other than that, you're just
picking and choosing.
Yeah,
exactly.
There's also the story of the various jurisdictions, which gets really confusing, particularly when you've got opposing political sides in the different jurisdictions.
Yes.
There's sheriffs, there's marshals.
Sheriffs, of course there are. Yeah, exactly. There's four layers of law enforcement and international politics in this. One of the things I tried to do was, again, draw back and say, what's the context for this? All those jurisdictions made a huge difference in how things played out. The fact that Mexico had a better case for going to war against the United States because of the depredations of the cowboys in the Sonoran cattle country than we had when we went to war against them 30, 40 years earlier during the Mexican War. Nobody ever mentions that, but they were very close to declaring war on the United States. And the other huge national moment was that the same day that the first catastrophic fire wiped out most of Central Tombstone was also the day that they found out that James Garfield, the president, had been shot in the back by what's always called a disappointed office worker, Charles Guiteau, who was totally nuts. It took Garfield months to die, and he died just weeks before the gunfight at the OK Corral. It was in response to the looting and the lawlessness after the fire and to the president's being shot that the City Council of Tombstone put through draconian gun control laws. That's what the gunfight at the OK Corral was about. It was about disarming people who were carrying guns inside city limits. So you have a city council that says it's way too dangerous. And it's also its businessmen who wanted people from the East not to be reading about, you know, people being killed in bar fights and stuff. And they wanted investment. So they needed to get a grip on this. And they lived in the town. And they didn't want to be hit by a stray bullet. They had their wives and their kids in that. So, yeah, it was draconian. It was even worse, more strict than the gun control laws in Dodge City, where you had to check your gun when you crossed city limits. In Tombstone, you couldn't carry knives either. Any lethal weapon had to be checked.
There's a scene in a restaurant where Doc is confronted. Is that real?
It is real to this extent. All of the Earp women, they were scared to go out by themselves. It's almost purdah. You know, the women of the 1800s did not go out without a male accompanying them. And they had to dress very carefully. And it was, you know, it was very dangerous. What did their husbands talk about? Crime. Well, they finally got to the point where they decided they were going to go downtown. This really happened. They dressed up and they went downtown and they were taken out to eat. Virgil's honey, Elvira Sullivan, they never married, but they were together for decades and decades. A friend of the family took them out to eat. Now, she didn't say it was Doc Holliday, but who else did they know in town? So I just kind of filled that in. And it was a way of revealing each of the ladies and this instantaneous hostility between Johnny Ringo, and Doc Holliday. Doc, I don't think, asked for that kind of hostility. I think that Johnny Ringo brought it with him to that confrontation.
Well, Holiday also had a reputation at that point.
A reputation, exactly. Yes, yes. And as he says in Doc, reputation, reputation, reputation. It is off God without merit and lost without deserving.
Well, I mean, you've also got anything that happens, suddenly the gossip is going to spread.
Yes, of course.
And then you've got dishonest newspapers.
Sure.
So how do you find anything out?
I always begin with the childhoods of the people that I'm representing. And if you know John Henry Holliday's childhood, it is impossible to accept him as the gambler and gunman that he was made out to be in later years when he was just a character to be used. He was so ashamed of being a gambler that he concealed it from his family for as long as he could. When he was identified as a sporting man in the news that came out about the gunfight, now he was deputized for that, but he was also identified as a sporting man. That means a professional gambler. And in those days, to be a professional gambler was, for a male, like being a whore for a woman. You were doing for money what respectable people did for entertainment. His father never spoke his name again.
All of the story and epitaph takes place within the confines at the beginning and end of the story of the life of Josie Marcus,
yeah,
who was the, quote, wife of Wyatt Earp.
She was definitely common law. I don't believe that they were ever legally, but she was definitely his common-law wife, no question.
I've been to the grave in Colma, in the Jewish cemetery of Wyatt Earp.
Yeah.
Of Wyatt Earp.
He's buried with her family. And they were Jews from Posen, originally, who then emigrated to Brooklyn. Her father was not a banker, he was a baker. But Josie had a rather casual relationship with the truth.
Let me ask you about that, then. He was a baker. The story is he's a banker. That's in the book.
Yeah. Okay, first of all, you've got this Jewish family living in a tenement neighborhood. And they have, living with them, because you can tell from the census that who's in the household, one of them is an Irish laborer who is their boarder. Bankers don't live in a tenement with an Irish boarder who sleeps on the floor.
Did you find out specifically he was a baker?
If you look carefully at the handwriting, because, of course, the census taker has to write down, so his wife is housewife and the children are students or, you know, child or something like that. The Irish boarder is called a laborer. And if you look carefully, it says baker. It does not say banker.
It sounds like a lot of those serendipitous moments came up. How did that come up and what was the context?
I always check the census on anything. You know, just I go for as much detail as I can about the real people.
And this is before you started writing.
I do about a third of the research before I begin a novel, just to see if it will hold my interest for the 3 to 4 years that it takes me to write these things. And then as I go along, I go out and get more detail and, you know, well, how did that work? Those kind of questions come up later.
What was the most surprising thing that you found?
The fact that there were no cattle involved with the gunfight at the OK Corral. I bought the movie version, which was that it was the ranchers versus the lawmen. And again, this is why the book has Ike Clanton as a major character. Poor Ike.
Not the brightest bulb.
No, I think he, you know, this is not somebody who started with a triple-digit IQ, and his father probably concussed him on a regular basis. We know he was concussed the night before the gunfight. He was out cold for 2 hours. That's a serious concussion. And what does he do afterwards? He goes out bar hopping. Worst thing you can do with a concussion is drink. Yeah, Ike was not bright, but a kind of tragic figure on his own. And like Wyatt, they were the same age. They were both the sons of fathers who were notorious for ungoverned rage and who would beat the hell out of the kids. And they both had younger brothers whom they took pride in protecting from the father's wrath. And so they had a lot in common. Neither one of them was well-educated. I think Wyatt was dyslexic. I think Ike never was anywhere long enough to go to school. I think there was a bond between them. And the justification for that is that Wyatt Earp went to Ike Clanton, knowing that any association with the Clantons would undermine him politically. But he went to Ike and he said, if you will tell me where the robbers of the Benson stage are, if you rat out your buddies, I will give you the $3,000 reward and I will get the political advantage of having brought them in. They trusted one enough to make that deal. That bespeaks a certain comfort in one another's presence. Now, that all fell apart.
Right.
But they were willing to do it in the beginning. Like, rather than just ignore that that happened because it's hard to explain, I needed to explain it.
You said that you cut a lot out of the book to bring it down to size. Was some of that involving John Behan and the politics of the era?
Not Johnny Behan. I cut back on John Klum, the mayor. I just kept hacking away. He was much more interesting than I made him, and he had a wife and children who died. And, you know, one of the ranchers who took the Earps in at the end of the Vendetta ride, I had a lot on him. There's a whole biography of him. And the man who was elected sheriff of the northern county, Bob Paul. There was, again, a really interesting biography on him. But, again, he just appeared for short stretches, so I took a lot out of him.
What happens is, as you find out, more and more people come in. I mean, the guy who shot Jesse James even puts in an appearance.
Yeah, well, that happened right at the same time. That kind of thing lets people who know the West, it gives them an opportunity to, like, get a hook, an anchor in time. And all of this is going on at the same time. And the newspapers loved it.
Mary Doria Russell, part of your research, apparently you spent days on horseback following the path of the posse that came after
the killers of Morgan. And this was something that I don't think very many people have done. There's a wonderful quote from Mark Twain that says, "A man who carries a cat home by the tail is getting 30 or 40 times the information of the man who just watches." You get on a horse and ride that terrain. It is hard riding. It is very difficult for the horse. It's very difficult for the rider. The mountains around Tombstone, it's like riding over giant piles of clinker brick. It's irregular. It's loose. And if your horse stumbles or if you lose your seat, you're going to hit rock and or cactus. I mean, I was 60 and healthy. Doc was 30 and dying. Okay, so I figured, well, that gives us sort of a, right. You know, that's kind of equivalent. The theory for most people who write about this is that because Doc was with that posse, they say to themselves, he must have been in the best health of his life to have done that. No. When lung tissue is destroyed by tuberculosis, it doesn't come back. It's gone. He was very frail. He was not strong. He wasn't supposed to be on that posse, and there again is something I just... If you look carefully at the sequence of events, who's the last person you want on a posse? No, I don't think Wyatt wanted him on it.
To give a brief story, what you have in Tombstone, the people on the side of the law, the people who are all trying to make a living however they can, you have this conflict, people are killed, at which point Wyatt Earp turns into a crazed vigilante and goes after everybody. Because what has happened is that the response to the gunfight is that his brother has been killed.
Yeah. This is why I think we keep telling the story. This is a story of what happens when the justice system fails. There was at least one unarmed person who was killed in the gunfight. And there were two others who were, in fact, armed and did fire. There's no question. There was a 30-day hearing to see whether or not the Earps and Holliday should be indicted for unjustifiable homicide. And after a very careful consideration of the law, they were cleared. If you read this, you'll understand why you don't get an indictment on cops. It is a special standard that they are held to, and they were not culpable legally. What Ike Clanton infers from this is that the only way to get justice for his dead brother, Billy died in his arms moments after the gunfight. This is the boy that he raised himself. This is the boy he protected from his father. Billy bleeds to death in his arms, and it's not a crime. So at that point, he is ready to go after the Earps individually. He was involved with crippling Virgil Earp, who never regained use of his arm again, and he was involved with killing Morgan Earp. Even that didn't send Wyatt off the rails. What sent him off the rails at the end was he was taking his brother's body back to where his parents lived, and he got word that they were waiting to kill Virgil. And that's when he just lost it. And in the next 96 hours. He killed at least five men. Judge, jury, executioner. And this is why I framed these two stories. Doc is the Odyssey. It's a wily man made more so by his wanderings. Epitaph is the Iliad. You see this Homeric rage. And when he virtually destroys the body of Frank Stillwell, firing over and over and over into it, it's like Achilles dragging Hector's body around the walls of Troy 8 times.
The chapter headings, are those from the Iliad?
All from the Iliad, yeah. And it maps remarkably closely to the story of the Iliad.
I kept thinking, as I was reading Epitaph, Mary Doria Russell, I kept thinking that if you were going to write a contrarian novel of this story and go completely the other way, you could make the Earps the real villains.
Oh, they are seen that way. You know, like I said, there are Clantons who still live in Tombstone, and the McLowries are still very bitter. There's a phrase in the finding that the fact that Tom McLowry was unarmed was of no importance. Then imagine 40 feature films showing Wyatt Earp as a handsome hero and Tommy McLowry as a violent outlaw who deserves to die. Yeah, they're bitter. And they do see it the other way around. I thought that was equally unfair. So what I have tried to do is tell the stories as accurately and as compassionately as I can. But it's everybody's stories, not just Wyatt and Doc's. It's Tommy's and Ike's and all the rest of them.
You know, I kept coming back to John Ford's comment from
Liberty Valance. Yeah.
Print the legend.
Yeah. Well, everybody has. And I'm delighted that the Epitaph is being featured, I'm told. I haven't been out to Tombstone since it came out, but friends of mine have been there. And they say that Epitaph is being featured in every store in Tombstone. I went down there. I talked to people. I took their attitudes toward the – and we don't call them outlaws. You call them ranchers when you're down there. And I took it seriously. And I have not lied about anybody as far as I can tell.
At what point did you realize that you kind of had to stop the research? Because you could have gone on indefinitely.
No, you do get to a point where you think, I have just got to stop this. I knew what I was aiming at. I wanted to bring it up to 1954 when The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp debuts with Hugh O'Brien on ABC. And one of the things that was so amazing to me about this is that it comes into living memory. I watched that when I was a kid. To know that Josie got her way. For a long, long time. She got the epitaph she wanted for Wyatt. Now, I'm her rival in that. I'm fair to Wyatt, but I don't idolize him the way that she did.
Why did you choose to bring in the young gay couple at the end?
There was such a thing. We broke new historical ground with that. People knew about John Flood. Okay, John Flood was a middle-aged mining engineer who was their neighbor when they were in their 60s and 70s and 80s for Josie. And he became involved with them, you know, helping them out with things and explaining things. And, you know, there was the new income tax and they had oil and gas revenues. And so he was the son they never had. I have my genealogy genies on Facebook. And I said, all right, somebody, can you find me on John Flood? Where does he come from? Is he, you know, and it turned out he was an orphan. He didn't have much of a family. But one of the women who was doing that research realized that there was a man named Edgar Beaver who was listed as living at the same address for 45 years. And they bought a house together. They were listed as business partners in Los Angeles. Well, clearly, this is an early. It would have been so grim. Josie was becoming increasingly demented. Wyatt was very sick at the end. It was a sad end for these two people. But when Edgar walks into this novel, his voice was so clear to me, and he was such a delight to write for. That became my favorite part of the book.
As I was reading this and comparing the legend of Wyatt Earp with the reality, mm-hmm. the West has come and gone in so many ways to a point where I understand you had a little trouble getting Epitaph published.
That was something entirely separate.
Oh, it was not
part
of that.
Yeah, that was a corporate decision at Random House, and God bless them, they picked me up at Echo and have done really nicely by this book.
Well, I was just wondering if that had to do with their fears that a book about the West wouldn't sell.
They made the decision before Doc came out. So before it got all of these phenomenal reviews. And Epitaph has been uniformly praised. I never got a straight answer for why they suddenly decided to drop me. But it was their decision.
It struck me in that decision that it could have had something to do with the up and down popularity of Westerns.
I don't even know that it was that. I have never had the same editor be at any company that I've worked at who bought the book and then was there when it was published. I've had like 12 editors for 6 books. Come on. There's been no continuity. So apart from the first 1.5 books, my books have always been stepchildren. They've always landed on somebody else's desk, and it's like, okay, so-and-so.
They called the orphans.
Yeah, they have been orphaned. And I think that we just got to the point where I was with somebody who they've left. They've had babies and left the publishing business. They died. They went to other houses. It's been one thing after another.
Well, one of the reasons I brought this up is because of the West and the ups and downs. I mean, right now, the big movies are all these superhero movies.
Yeah.
On some level,
yeah,
I know this is crazy, but on some level, there isn't that much difference between Thor and Wyatt Earp.
Well, yeah, publishers are, it's an industry. They're there to make money. They're looking for something that is going to be made into the next 50 Shades of Grey or Divergent or, you know, things where there's going to be a franchise of vampire movies or, you know, you name it. And I change genres and I change topics and I'm all over the place on stuff like that. No, there isn't a built-in audience for some of the stuff I do. On the other hand, Echo, which is my publisher for this book, have done three big Westerns in the last 3 years. They did The Sisters Brothers, they did The Sun, and now Epitaph.
One of the things I always ask is, anybody take out an option? And the difficulty here, of course, is that, you know, from My Darling Clementine and Tombstone and all of these others.
But every generation we get a new Doc and Wyatt. Yeah. For Doc, we initially had an option on that book by Akiva Goldsman and Ron Howard. And they were interested in developing it as a series for HBO. And HBO passed, and so that was dropped. My guess is that maybe because it took place only over a year's time, it might not have had enough of an arc for them to get involved in all of the costumes and the scenery and all that, even if they could reuse a lot of stuff from Deadwood. I have kind of hoped that maybe with Epitaph, because that gives you a much broader arc, that the two books could be combined and do something with them, but there has been, as far as I know, there has been no interest.
I guess it keeps coming back. It's like Three Musketeers.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point,
it might.
One would think that it could.
Yeah.
Mary Doria Russell, now you've written these Westerns. Your next book is about a strike?
Yes.
What story?
Again, I'm drawn to those I feel have been unfairly maligned. And right now, I think that's the American labor movement. The book that I'm working on right now, it's about the 1913 copper strike in Calumet, Michigan. And the quick reason I got involved with this is that on Christmas Eve, at a party in 1913, 59 children were killed because their parents were trying to unionize the copper mines. I think that's a story that should be told. And it's interesting to me because I don't like good guys and bad guys. And the Calumet and Hecla mines were run by James McNaughton, who was the most progressive mine operator in the world. Really remarkable. The strike was called by a 25-year-old woman named Annie Clements, who was the president of the Ladies Auxiliary of the Western Federation of Miners, Local 15, 6'3" tall, beautiful girl. When she said, "We're going out," 15,000 miners laid down their tools. It was bad judgment. They had no strike fund. It was the wrong company to strike. It was the wrong time to strike. She was going to be the next Mother Jones. She was a wonderful union organizer, and it was the wrong thing to do. So I've got a very nuanced story to tell.
Is she kind of the protagonist then?
They both are. They both are. And I'm doing the story as a kind of, in the same way that I use quotes from the Iliad to frame Epitaph, I'm framing this one with Romeo and Juliet. The quotes just jump out at me.
Did they meet?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was not a big town. Yeah. The Romeo and Juliet are a 14- and 15-year-old girl. The 14-year-old girl is union. The 15-year-old is not.
When you walk away from a book like Epitaph, how do you wind up feeling?
I mean, I spend 3 to 4 years on each one of these topics, and I go way deep on the history. I mean, my interest in tombstone mining probably set me up to be interested in the copper strike, because it's the same thing. It's hard rock mining, and you're 2 miles underground, and it's very difficult work, and it takes a lot of capital investment even to do it. I had that background to be able to go on with this. I read to learn. I write to learn more fully and in more detail, to understand better. The very first words in Epitaph are to understand what happened in Tombstone. When Trayvon Martin was killed and George Zimmerman was exonerated, the emotional reaction to that was exactly the same as you saw after the gunfight at the OK Corral. The kid in the hoodie who comes back from the 7-Eleven with his package of Skittles, gunned down and unarmed, you know, not just out. And some wannabe cop comes along and he doesn't do time for that. Yeah, that's hard for people to get their minds around. And since then, there's been, you know, one shooting after another. But as a cop's daughter, I'm not willing to just go the opposite direction and say, you know, these guys are the bad guys.
Was everybody in Tombstone white?
Large Chinese population. Some Mexican, although Mexicans were not well thought of. Not many blacks. On the West in general, about 20% of the people who were ranch hands were black. It was more mixed than you would expect on the frontier. Larry McMurtry in Lonesome Dove does have a black cowboy, so that lets you know that they were out there. And in Doc, the central character is a black kid who gets killed.
You've been listening to an interview with Mary Doria Russell, whose latest novel is Epitaph, a novel of the O.K. Corral, which follows on the heels of Doc, which is a novel about Doc Holliday. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.